Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Man, we are traveling the world to, we're kind of de-sharking the ocean of rhetoric. We're taking the bad people out, putting them in the wood chipper of rhetorical analysis. That's the idea anyway. I'm Dr. Dan French, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Podcast does three things. We talk to comedians about their careers and their politics, and I let them do uncensored comedy on here, which has been super fun. I also convert conservatives because the right concerns me. I think they're a little off the path. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians because I like it. It's what I do. Today is another episode of Persuasion Pros and kind of Rhetorician Files. She's both, and she's comedy. Like, she's triple, I don't know, quadruple threat. So my guest today has a rhetoric and writing degree from UT Austin, English. I did comm study speech. She did English. Very cool stuff. She's a full-time persuasion industry professional, communications manager out there in the Bay Area. I know her from stand-up. She took a stand-up class from me years ago, and we'll talk about that. I have a great story about how she traumatized my kids with one of her bits. And I think she's a social issue person. She's, you know, young and millennial-ish, and, you know, and the best thing, she's not a middle-aged white guy. And I've had 53 guests, I think, so far, and 42 have been middle-aged white guys. I think because, I don't know, that's what I grew up with. That's the people who say yes to me. So she's going to add some flavor and some style and some difference, and that's super cool. That's what she does. Devanya Batiste.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Dr. Dan French, really appreciate that. I mean, hey, you know, you pretty much ran the gamut of like presidents, right? You know, you got to get through a whole bunch of white dudes and then you're right? Like, okay, let me add a little bit of flavor, a little bit of spice up in there.
How does that not concern anybody when they look on the wall and they see nothing but white dudes?
Hey, look, it's like, you know, you've had a mayonnaise sandwich your whole life. Someone throws in mustard. You're like, oh, shit. Okay, I get it now. Maybe I could have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So, you know, until it's brought to your attention, you'd be surprised all of the nuanced systemic issues that people don't even realize, you know, but yeah, until it's
insane. Like, even, I mean, my background, I'm from Kentucky, right? And I grew up in a very old school, you know, traditional redneck working class culture. And then I went to grad school and went into cultural studies. And, you know, I was just fascinated with all that stuff because I'd never been exposed to any of that type of intellectual approach to anything.
Yeah.
And it just like instantly, like, oh my God, there's all this great thinking going on in the world from all these different cultural perspectives. It's awesome.
Yeah. But
other people are like, oh, there's all this other shit in the world coming at me and it's terrible. I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a train going by. All right. Sorry about that.
You
know, live near the tracks in the Bay Area. You know, I'm on the right side of the tracks. That's what happens when you work in corporate tech America. But still.
Yeah.
Still
run your background a little bit. Orient everybody to Devanya Batiste. By the way, best name ever. Who named you?
Thank you. Thank you. My parents did. They were being, you know, they're being cute with it. Little do they know my name is actually Gaelic. We are not Gaelic at all. There's no even teeny bit of Gaelic.
Black Irish.
You know, they're just being black and being like, yeah, this shit's fire. And I was like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah,
funnily enough. Yeah. You know, funnily enough, we found out that my grandfather, you know, a couple of years ago, we did the ancestor test and stuff. He's 13% Irish. And I'm engaged to an Irish guy. So it's like I'm finally, it's all making sense. It's all making sense.
Pulling you back.
But yeah, so, you know, I mean, like you said, I went to UT, have a degree in rhetoric and writing.
Yeah, tell me about that. What was that like in the English department, like from a rhetoric degree? Because I was in the speech department. Were you guys just like hardcore writers, or was it just out in the world? Like, rhetoric gets out and messes with all the messaging in the world.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I really learned from it was rhetoric is everything, right? I mean, it's how you dress, you're conveying a message to people, you're trying to persuade people to believe something that you want them to believe about yourself. It is how you talk, the kinds of words that you're using, you know, code switching, right? You know, like me being a Black American, I code switch often. That is a form of rhetoric on who I'm trying to appeal to and let them know, you know, that I'm a part of their community. And so the rhetoric class, you know, the programming at UT is fascinating because you had an opportunity to really choose your own path. Like, what kind of rhetorician did you want to be? And so when I first started getting into it, I said, okay, you know, I love rhetoric, but I really only want to use it for good. And so I kind of careened my pathway into public relations, right? And actually took a rhetoric of laughter class, which I think you would have really enjoyed.
Nice. All right.
And I have a book from that still that I read called Ha. And it's amazing. It talks about kind of what makes you laugh and why people don't laugh at certain things. And I believe I was finishing that class when I started doing your class, which was fantastic. Highly recommend to anyone, you know, Dr. French's comedian class, and just like, you know, solidifying that your jokes, they may not land with people, but you got to drive them home no matter what, right? I mean, that's what it is. Don't pass them up, like drive them home. And so it was fascinating. So I took a lot of classes that allowed for me to be a public relations professional. I mean, the rhetoric degree at UT leads you to three paths, right? You can either be a lawyer, and I was like, no, no thanks. You can either do technical writing, and I was like,
yeah,
or public relations. And I was like, okay, I can do public relations for what I feel are, you know, are important missions, issues, stuff like that. So after I graduated, I went on and became a part of a PR firm, which is fine if you, you know, like getting fucked in the ass all day, every day from different dicks, you know, like it's like you've got different clients, so it's different sizes, different lengths.
I mean, it's corporate,
you're like, what? Huh? Like, I can't, I've only got like two hands and I'm in one mouth. You know, I don't have a lot to work with, right? I was like, I just...
Yeah, you can't be a one-woman orgy, right? You can't, come on.
You know, I mean, I've tried, but you can't, like, you know, you're gonna get so sticky to a point where you're like, okay, I gotta get out of this.
Really, right? Guys, still, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So I left being in a PR firm and went into corporate America. So it was only one dick that I'm getting fucked with. You know, just one. And I'm like, okay, you know, I can deal with that. The hours are long still. It causes a lot of chafing emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually.
But other than that, it's fine.
But
I get a paycheck.
Hey, look, I'm a classic millennial, right? I'm very much so like anti-capitalist, but I got to get that bag. Like, I'm trying to live. Like,
there's no other way to go through America.
There's no other way.
They block all the paths. The only thing that opens them up is money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, I've always been personally very fascinated, very jealous, envious, really, of just the strength of the abilities and just the skills of prostitutes, you know, because I mean, they get paid for something that I enjoy. And I mean, they get paid like big bucks. And I'm like, fuck, man, I can't do my makeup that well. My hair is always kind of a mess. Like, you know, I got to shave everywhere. Are you kidding me? Like,
There's a lot to that work.
Bushwhacker. You can't just roll out of bed
as a prostitute.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, right? Like, but I can do that in corporate America and just throw on a little fucking headscarf and they're just going to think I'm like really diverse. Like, nah, right. Prostitutes, right. Like,
yeah, all, you can't just roll out of bed before you roll into bed.
Oh, absolutely not. Like, you know, they got their shit on point, the high heels they wear, or, you know, like porn stars. It's just like, damn, man, if only I had the gumption, I'd be doing that instead of, you know, sucking the proverbial capitalist teat.
Yeah. Well, it's selling your body or selling your mind, right? Just what do you want to sell?
Exactly. Are you kidding me? Like, it's like, you know, they say 9 to 5, it's not 9 to 5. And that shit definitely hasn't been 9 to 5 since the whole pandemic. You kidding me? I mean, it's honestly, it's been pretty fucked up. Like, a lot of people my age that are, you know, in corporate America, specifically in tech, they're hurting real bad. Honestly, the mental health problem is, it's unfortunate. I mean, I hear every day, whether it's from, you know, coworkers or people like me, just how tired they are. And I just totally understand where we're coming from, because it's hard to draw a line. Many of us are still struggling with our student debt or any other debt that we've accrued. So we have a hard time saying no to bosses, because if we say no, you know, I mean, you say no to John in a hotel, he might slap you around and shit. You say no in a company, they'll fire your ass. And I'd rather, honestly, someone just whoop my ass than get fired. The job market.
John can't fire you from prostitution, right?
Yeah. I mean, I could walk away with one less sore hole and be like, yeah, you know, I'll go get a massage. You get fired, you lose your benefits.
It's weird though. It's like, my daughter is 21, my son's 18, and my son's out in he's got his own company now. He like just literally launched out of high school into a business. Mm. My daughter's finishing up
college. Congratulations to him.
Yeah. And he's doing great. But like, I look at the difference in the way that they, like, he was offered a full-time job. He does video editing for games for an online multiplayer game universe. And they love what he does. And the mothership company's like, we want to hire you full time. And he's telling me, he's like, you know, they want me to be there like 3 hours a day. Like, I have to be on call. And then I'm like, yeah, I get it. I said, but watching this orientation to work versus like my dad's generation, because I was sort of in the middle, like they just went dead inside to handle it, you know?
Like, yes.
It was no better back then. Like, he hated his job in a lot of ways too, but they didn't expect to not be dead inside. But my kids were like, I'm not accepting an inner death in return for work.
I love that about Gen Z. You know, like every day when I log on to work and I plaster my smile and I'm like, hi, everyone, how's it going? Like, slowly but surely, I am like beating my own insides. You know, I am ending it. And I have a niece who's, you know, in high school now. And so I think she's part of the Gen Z crowd. I just appreciate the shit out of them. I know that typically, you know, intergenerationally, you've got generations shitting on the one underneath and the one above. You know, Gen X, I don't blame them. Like, they kind of got in the weird mix of like, they're like in a weird shit sandwich, you know, where the two breads are actually the shit and the inside is like, you know, salami. Like, you got boomers shitting on the millennials. You got millennials shitting upwards, like anti-diarrhea. And the Gen X's are just like, eh. Gen Z, meanwhile, you know, they're just a toilet. They're the function. They're like, yo, like, we gotta change how things work around here. You gotta fix this plumbing, because otherwise I ain't gonna work. I ain't gonna do this shit. And I mad respect. Like, I can't wait to get to a point where managerially, so I can hire a lot of young people. I think that there is there are definitely a lot of age discrepancies and discrimination, you know, both with senior people and also younger people, right? It's like, oh, they don't know that much, blah, blah, blah. Well, like, man, in marketing and PR, you've got, I mean, these kids, they are making political statements that go viral on TikTok. Like, that's amazing. If you can tap into that, if you can actually get those kinds of kids, those kind of people, I mean, honestly, it's beautiful. Like, shit, the millennials, we were just making weird ass cat videos on YouTube. Now we have 100 cats. I got rid of 99 of mine. I have one still. And she's an angry black pussy. I don't know where she is. So she pops up.
It's fun to watch. Like, my son knows how to do all that stuff, and he knows how to capitalize it. Mm-hmm. Like, he was getting, you know, he gets paid a sponsorship. he gets paid, he makes money with his YouTube. Like, he knows how to actually capitalize that stuff. And I think that's the difference of these guys coming up. They've seen, you know, people flame up and they understand a lot of the mechanisms inside of it, but he's always attaching it back to cash. He's like, yeah, I don't want to do this if I'm not going to make money with it, you know, because that money's going to allow me to do what I want instead of having to deal with, again, you know, the older generation telling him to work. It's like, you know.
Man. Yeah. I mean, and to me, I find that utterly fantastic. Like, so an example I've seen of this is, so at my job, I am also a co-chair for this thing called an employee resource group. We have many of them, but my employee resource group is specifically for Black, African American, and Hispanic, Latinx employees. Yeah, that should tell you how many we have. we had to bundle all in one. Hey, all of you brown minorities, just, you know,
you're the same.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. It's
just, yeah. I mean, you guys hang out in the same neighborhoods, right? You know? So anyways, during Black History Month, we had two speakers. One of them was, you know, not an older lady, but, you know, past in middle age. She had been a CEO, that sort of thing. And she was like, you know, I just don't believe in work-life balance. Like, I don't like that statement because there's no such thing as work-life balance. You just prioritize when you need to prioritize. I was like, okay. Then we had another dude who was a millennial and he, you know, worked for a tech company and he, like, you know, as part of their diversity inclusion. And he came with energy. He was like, yo, get paid for your time. I was like, yes. I was like, all of us were just like, abso-fucking-lutely, you know, but you're exactly right. It's that mindset. And I look, salary, you know, yeah, it's got me by the ovaries, but it's just astounding what can happen to you in that situation where work and home, just, they don't separate. And I hate to say it, but in those times it's like, damn, I miss waiting tables. You know, like I was in the service industry for a long time, like almost a decade, you know, working from fast food. And then in the last 5 years of me working, I was, you know, waiting tables and bartending downtown in Austin. And, you know, when you were done with work, that was it.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. When I clocked off, man, I would literally be clocking out and be ringing up like a shot and a beer at the same time. I'm like, I'm looking at my boss like, bitch, don't you dare ask me to come on. I'm not even like legally able to be working right now. So.
Well, and like you said, the mental health issue of not having separation in your worlds, exhaustion, never, no recovery, you know, space from exhaustion. Like I hated being a professor. Like it was kind of the same thing. Like you're servicing 200-300 kids and you know, if you're doing it right, you have some awareness of them, right? And there's some responsibility to them. But like stand up, like when you're traveling and doing stand up, you just have to be at the show at 7:45. And if you're the headliner, 8:45, because there's 45 minutes of other comics. So get in at like 8:30, 8:35, and you're fine.
Yeah.
Your 2 hours, go home, go back to the hotel room, and it's so clean. And you can do whatever you want all day long.
Yeah.
All day long.
Yeah. I mean, it's work. Like you know, you spend some time writing your sets, practicing them, all of that.
But that's fun. It's
exactly. Like, you know, it's fun. And it has like a timeline. Like when you're done with it, you're done. You can even say, you know what? I'm not going to practice today because my set isn't until whatever. Right. I mean, it's this really weird. We stopped having this kind of end of the workday as soon as the internet really, really took off, because now you've got emails, now you've got smartphones and all of that. So your bosses know, they could reach you whenever. However, And never mind the fact that I'm in PR, the 24-hour news cycle. Why the hell did I do this? I have no idea. I mean, look, to be honest.
Well, you have the skills, and the culture will pay for those skills. That's it. That's the whole explanation. Like, oh, yeah. I can write. I can communicate. I can think like this. Oh, look at this. They pay for this. Eh, I guess I'll go do that.
Exactly. And I mean, for people who don't typically, hang out with Black people, I have a very great, good way of making older white men, older corporate white men feel comfortable. Like me and you are tight because, you're just tight. Like you've always been cool. But
I hung around stand-up and entertainment, and even academics. It's so interpenetrated. I'm very comfortable across cultures. And I also know I don't know shit about, like, somebody will come in from, Thailand or something, and I'll be like, well, I don't know shit about Thailand. So I've got some skills to be able to, not try to impose my thoughts into something where I'm completely ignorant, which is basically all you really need to go across cultures. Exactly. Is a little bit of humility,
Well, yes, that is true. And there is such a funny kind of fine line that many workers of color in the corporate world have to kind of navigate, because more often than not, we're actually asked to do emotionally performative things.
Right.
That has nothing to do with our job. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
And so it can be very taxing. It can be emotionally taxing for me to have to explain why this sentencing or this protest or, or this murder of another Black body is problematic, or even not, I got to show up to work the next day. I have to show up to work the next day, kind of just being like, oh, well, whatever. Hey, everyone, fucking Mickey Mouse and shit. When that's actually, it's exhausting. Mickey Mouse. Yeah. And
because Mickey Mouse was good about, cops shooting Black people. Like Mickey Mouse.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. No, Mickey's great.
Walt Disney, the whole Disney World empire, is the closest thing I always looked at and like, that seems fascist. Like the stuff they make and everything else, it seems like it was organized like as a Nazi entity.
It definitely was. Like, I mean, there's so much racism.
He even got a little mustache.
Happens. Yeah. Right? I mean,
Walt even had a little mustache.
Walt was walking around fucking telling people this is the happiest place on earth. But on the inside, he was like, this is the happiest, whitest place on earth. I mean, every single time a Black person probably steps foot on the ground, he's like flipping over in his grave, like fast enough to fucking fuel a nuclear power plant.
I think there was a little bit. I did a little research on him once. And I think there was kind of a, like, he did some support, of kind of the Nazi groups and some of that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't want to slam the guy. He's dead. Who cares? He's got a frozen head somewhere. But there's a little bit of that. But it just has that feeling, maybe because it's so totalitarian. Like, the experience is all controlled. You're in lines. You do this. You don't do that. It's a little weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're pretty much like lining up for a camp where you get fat and happy and then you leave depressed and you're like, wait, maybe if I just go one more time, I'll be happy for the rest of my life. Like, it's the whole setup. The whole thing is set up,
Why is that the happiest place on earth? You're implying that my life out here is unhappy and it sucks.
Yeah.
If I pay you, I'll get a little bit of the happiness that you stole from the rest of the world, and sucked down into this space with its castles and all its crazy characters.
Well, maybe that's what happened. Maybe somehow or another, he's like, sapping our energy and like pumping it into the air.
He's taking all the happy.
Yeah, he's taking
and reselling all of that. It to us.
Fucking knew
son
it.
Of a bitch.
I knew these antidepressants were kind of fishy.
They probably have little mermaids on them and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they got me talking like Mickey, like, hoo-hoo, kids, hoo-hoo.
My thing going across like organizations and class lines, like, is class. Like, I came from the working class, so I'm much more brutal, my language, my attitudes, and, you know, things like that, than people from middle class and upper class. And I've run into this a lot in academics. But like, class, people can't see. I mean, race and stuff, people can see. Gender, they can see. The fact that you dress differently, they can see. Like, with me, like, I had a guy I was doing consulting for once, and I wear a black t-shirt and jeans. I don't care where I'm at. I don't care what my job is.
That's true. If I saw you in anything else, I'd start kind of freaking out.
That's my thing. You know, I don't like anything else. I don't like suits. I don't like ties. It's all upper culture bullshit. It's uncomfortable. Yep. And so this guy was like, I came in like the second time I worked with him doing some consulting, and I had my black t-shirt, and he goes, "Hey, thanks for getting dressed up." I'm like, "Well, why are you wearing that stupid shirt in the middle of the day when nobody's coming in here but me? You know, you got a tie on, starched shirt. What the fuck's wrong with you?" At least the pandemic has lowered our requirements for how people dress at work.
Oh, 100%. Like, sometimes I'll just have just a shirt on, and then like I just took the robe just and put it around my lap. I mean, I'm not going to stand up. Are you kidding me? No one sees the bottom half of this. Like, it's fun. Like,
I could always move through organizations, you know, white guy, masculine, people at least thought they knew that how to categorize that, right?
Sure.
Then they'd talk to me, and I was also a comedian, so I don't shut that off very well.
Oh yeah.
And working class, so suddenly, like, they're hearing me say fuck and shit like that, and they're like, "Ah, you're breaking the world." But I didn't have to deal with like stuff like I said, like gender and race and stuff like that, which is, you know, it's just a beacon for everybody.
Ugh. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, actually go a little bit further on my background. You know, me being from Texas, born and raised, and from Houston. I think that was a profound experience growing up, because I've had to deal with a lot of boundary crossings my entire life. You know, if I had been raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and then moved out to the Bay Area, where the only Black people are in Oakland, or I had instead lived in, I don't know, West Virginia, where there's only white people, and I had, you know, still didn't have any identity. Houston is the perfect kind of conglomerate for that, because right, you're in Texas, so you're still in a red ass fucking state, but you've got a whole lot of Black people in Houston. But then you've got a whole lot of white run areas, you know? And so it allowed for me to understand how to blend in, how to speak different languages, and kind of how to digest some of the things that would be said to me for the rest of my life. I don't expect for anyone to stop saying shit like, "You know, you're really pretty for a Black girl."
What? You know?
And I'm like,
nobody tags that like that, do they?
Oh yeah. You know, and I'm always like, "Hey, like, like, thanks, but how do you know if I'm a girl?" Like, like, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what's going on with me. And or people would say shit like, "Cause I have a mohawk, and I've had a mohawk off and on or whatever, and I've had colorful hair." And people be like, "Oh, you know, like, hey, do the carpet matches the drapes?" I'm like, "Carpet? Nigga, I got hardwood." Like, so, I mean, I've had to deal with a lot of kind of crazy shit, just being who I am and growing up in Texas and having different sorts of political ideologies pushed onto me and forming my own thoughts and ideas, to where I think that's honestly what makes me the most successful in corporate America, because it taught me how to swat away the microaggressions, right? Because the aggressions I've had to deal with a lot, you know? And I think we are continuing to move in a positive direction, you know, socially, but
yeah, but you're in the Bay Area now. That does that? Do you think that because you're in, you know, probably you probably feel some of that energy. I walk outside of Austin, drive outside of here a little bit, and I'm like, we're making no progress at all.
Nah, man. don't be, you know, don't be faking all that funk. Look, I'll admit, San Francisco, liberal as fuck. But my, you know, where my company's located, Silicon Valley, which one of these CEOs is not white? Like it's, you know, and so, and still you have certain microaggressions where, like, I'm not from the Bay Area. And some people are like, oh, she, you're from Oakland. I'm like,
because, look at that.
because I'm black? What?
What?
Oh, no way. And that's when I pull out my gat and rob them. But the point being is that
they started it. They deserved it. I mean,
they did though. They did. But it, the, as liberal as I am, I still very much so see the facades of liberalism that doesn't make you question your own biases. Like, the housing crisis out here in the Bay Area is astronomically terrible, but the same liberals that are like, we need to build more housing, we need to do all of that, are NIMBYs. They're not in my backyarders. They're like, no, well, not housing here, why can't it be elsewhere, why can't it be, you know what I mean? And so those same people that think those thoughts will say the same dumb shit to me that gets said to me in Texas. Like, yeah, obviously, you know, like, they're not saying shit to me like some dude might say to me in Killeen, Texas, but the sentiment and the lack of understanding and the lack of empathy is still, you know, still the same.
Well, there's a big, I mean, there's, and people, again, when you do cultural studies, as an academic area, you get to really hear like hardcore ethnography and deep experience about other cultures. And so you start to realize just how deep it goes, you know, and exactly. So you see something like abstract liberalism, which is easy. Like in most Democrats, most people who are liberals are abstract liberals.
Absolutely.
Living it, that's a whole new thing. Like the homeless stuff. Like I had a friend who was very liberal and lived in Tampa and was, you know, pro helping the homeless and stuff like that. But his home was right on the edge of kind of a non-gentrified area. And the homeless started coming using his hose, taking a shower in his, taking a shit in his backyard. And all of a sudden he's like, you know what? We got to do something about this homeless problem. Like, yeah, when somebody shits in your backyard, it's no longer possible to be an abstract liberal, is it?
I mean, and you know what? Like, it's funny as fuck. I feel badly for your friend, but I also, it just makes me question how empathetic politically each side is, right? I'm, like I said, I'm liberal as fuck. I vote for a lot of very liberal things, but growing up in Texas and still and having friends that are conservative or libertarian, I can understand their concerns. And that's something that if we as a country are going to make any definitive changes, we've got to understand how to address these polarized feelings and still see each other eye to eye, right? Like, there are some things, for instance, you know, the whole thing in Texas about the, you know, fetus heartbeat bill, that shit sucks. Like, that is abhorrent, you know, especially to, I mean, to really to anybody. But these people who are in support of this legitimately believe that having an abortion is killing a human being, like a legitimate, like, it's like, if I was like, you know what, Dan, fuck you. I got on the plane or drove my ass over there and was like, man, I'm about to whoop this nigga ass until he is done for. Like, he is done. And I just walked away. That's literally how they see it. And so I challenge us to address their not so much as pro-life, but anti-choice and say, okay, no one wants abortions to happen. I don't wake up every day as right. a feminist.
It's literally two issues laid on top of each other that are both, they're incompatible and both true.
Exactly. Like, I don't wake up every day and I'm like, you know what? Today is a fine day to get an abortion. Like, we're not having abortion parties or any shit like that. I don't want them to happen to people because I know it can be a traumatic experience. But what we can do, what everyone should agree on, is like, you know, more sex education, more access to contraceptives, all of that. Because kids are kids, you know, they're going to make the mistakes or bad things are going to happen to people. And that should protect them. You don't want a child born that isn't wanted. That's sad. And to me, that's a real abortion. A kid that is born into a world that is not wanted and suffers and is in pain and just is hurt for the rest of their lives, whether it's short or long, that's what should be the most disgusting thing.
Yeah, it's one of those... I started this new part of the podcast of uncensoring censored standups. Mm-hmm. So like all standups, professional standups especially, end up not doing a lot of material because it'll cost them work and they don't want to get blowback from a live audience. And if you're doing this as a profession, you know, where you're paying your bills and you're for your family with this stuff, they end up cutting out like about 40% of their material most places they go. And so I have them on. I'm like, I want to hear all your censored bits, your self-censored bits. If you're doing it to yourself. And both the guys have talked about abortion. The first two episodes, abortion, really? One of the topics that's coming up. Cause it's really, like you said, it's one of those issues that just flames up everybody. But like my thing with conservatives, and this is what I do when I do the converting conservative stuff, is you do have to have empathy with it, but you have to actually understand it. It can't be false empathy, which is what everybody wants to do. Like, conservatives, you know, you gotta, like, there's a reason why white people, and especially, you know, rural white people and older white people in this country don't want change. It's because it is literally threatening to them. Yeah. They've been running the country for 200 years. And now some people are like, hey, why don't you share some of that? And they're like, you know, that doesn't sound as good to me. To share power and all that. I'm not sure I want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it just reminds me of my single days. And, you know, I mean, you fucking this dude. He's slanging that dick. He's fire. Like, you know, but you're not like together with him. Right. It's like, but, you know, you've got him on retainer. You've got him on speed dial. People who do that shit anymore. You Snapchat him. And then someone's like, hey, man. Can I bang this dude too? And you're like, wait, hold on. Just stop.
And I'm giving up my total access, my soul.
Yeah, I have total access. Like whenever I want it, however I want it. Like, and I have to give that up? Man, look, I'd be raising hell too. Shit. Like, so, I mean... It really is a lot for them to take into consideration. And also, there are some more nuanced issues. For instance, I fully believe that we have to do something about access to high-powered rifles, to, semi-automatic, automatic rifles, that sort of thing, as far as just access to everybody. At the same time, I love shooting guns. I go to shooting ranges. I practice. We're going to be closing on a house very soon. I very intend on owning a gun for my house. All of that. I don't think I should have an AR-15. That doesn't make any sense. When it comes to self-defense in a home, all you need is a shotgun. You don't really need, you know, any of that. Now, mind you, yes, you can still have your school shooting with a shotgun, but the range is not the same. And the ability to reload is not the same. And I think that people on the right, all they hear from us are being like, oh, just take away all guns. If that was a possibility, cool. Like, all guns are gone. That's not going to happen. That will never happen. I would be shocked.
Right. And but so, rhetorically, I mean, if you look at rhetoric, it's always, everybody always looks at rhetoric as monologue, like it's one-sided. And like that, in politics, that shit never happens. Like, as soon as, while you're saying this reasonable thing about, hey, why don't we dial this back a little bit and make it hard to get this? There's 4,000, you know, air horns over here just blaring out. They're stealing your guns. They want your gun. So your message, this reasonable message, just gets drowned in this thunder of, you know, the anti-message.
Yeah.
And Democrats don't understand that. And liberals don't understand that. Like, your message is coming out at about one decibel.
Yep.
And the other ones are coming out at 400 from 8,000 different sources. So if you want to win, guess what? Either increase your sources, increase your volume, you know, or quiet these people down where they're not hearing that other shit all the time and where you can talk to them. But just talking is not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and you brought up a good point. One of the things that I have always held on to since I learned it at UT is social judgment theory. And just the theory that everyone has issues that is either completely, you know, left or right, not politically, but just like, I completely believe in this or I completely don't. And then you're somewhere in the middle. A lot of us politically are very much so in the, I fully believe this. And it is very hard to move people there because according to social judgment theory, it means you're questioning yourself as a human being for believing in that. And what I beg any listener, anyone, is to really sit there and say, it's okay for me to have been wrong, you know? And I mean, I'm not a parent yet, but one of the things that I hope to do when I am a parent is, if I'm wrong, just to go back to my kid and be like, I was wrong. Like, I was wrong with that, because I've learned how to do that myself politically, and just in other psychological aspects of myself. Like, when I grew up in a Christian household, obviously that
obviously Jesus has left the building.
Yeah. I mean, look, because all I said to Jesus, I was like, yo, everyone's talking about that you inside them. You ain't been inside me yet. And haven't seen him since. And
he's really got to open up his humor.
Yeah. I mean, you know, shit. So I was very wrong about, when I was younger, my thoughts about the queer community, because I was raised with those thoughts, right? Like, oh, being queer, you know, you're going to hell and that sort of thing. It wasn't until middle school that when I met my first queer individuals, where I was like, oh, they're pretty much just like me. I don't see what this big deal is. And then there was this final instance that really solidified it for me. I was in the hair shop, you know, the hair salon shop, getting my hair did. And of course they have all these magazines and stuff. So I was reading a very powerful and touching story about this transgender woman who was a lesbian. And my dad had always told me that if a guy was gay, he was just wanting to be a woman to be with men. And so this story, this really touching story about this person who was a man, who loved women, but hated penetration because of their penis, realized they were a woman. Like, that's who they were on the inside. That's just who they needed to be. So they made the transition and they were a happy lesbian. It really, like, it clicked to me that, wait a second, the things that I've been told my life, this doesn't make any sense. Why would anyone ever do this? And so I said, okay, I was wrong. These ideas, I believed I was wrong. And obviously this is all when I was young, but it was built a great foundation for me to say throughout my life, and I've had plenty of these moments, I was wrong. I have not been right, and I will not always be right. And that's okay. Because if you grow as a human being and you learn more things about the world around you, I guarantee you that when the time for the long nap comes, you're going to sit there and say, okay, I made an impact on this world. I'm going to leave. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah. You see, I think I had an advantage growing up because I grew up in Kentucky and I was surrounded by ignorance. I was the first person in my family to go to college. Nobody around me was intellectual. Nobody read. And so I assumed from very early on that I was wrong, that I didn't know anything. When I went to college, I'm like, yeah, I'm ignorant. Like, you people need to teach me some stuff. And I've kept that like forever. Like, I know some things now about like comedy. I know some rhetoric, but my ignorance far outweighs my education. My education is just localized on these little things. So maybe it's because I grew up, you know, in seething ignorance that I have always been like, no, I'm sure what I believe is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ooh, Kentucky. Oh boy. Like, I don't know, man.
My family was pretty passive. Like, they weren't aggressive politically or socially. Yeah. They were just living their lives. So I didn't have a lot imprinted on me.
Yeah.
I was Catholic, but it was pretty laid back Catholic.
You know, laid back Catholic. That seems like an oxymoron.
Well, it was Kentucky. I mean, Baptists were the ones that were hardcore. The Catholics that got to Kentucky are just like, nah, we're going to play football and drink beer. You know? So it was pretty laid back. But I've always had that sense of like, even I don't have imposter syndrome. Like, when I know something or I know I'm good at it, I'm fine with it. But I have ignorance awareness for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that comes with just being from the South.
Like, but you know, so many of the ignorant don't have it. They're ignorant of their own ignorance.
Yeah. Well, God, can you blame if they never leave? I mean,
I just don't understand valorizing it. I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah. You have a thought. I get it. Congratulations. You haven't checked that thought anywhere. So why do you believe it so strongly? You need to check your thought, baby.
Let me ask you this though. So if you made the single batch bourbon by yourself, you did this and you've been drinking it, and you mind you still making it, it tastes great, you start sampling it to some of your friends and they're like, this is kind of fire, and then you bring it to the big city and people are like, nigga, this shit is wet. Like, and they really start dogging on it. You're going to start to get defensive. You're like, wait a second. Nobody gives a fuck about you, your daddy, your mama. And then you dip out and you go back to your own little small town and your own little friend group and your own little single small batch that you're making. You say, I'm fine with it. I'm good with it. That's how these people think.
No, that is a good simile, metaphor, comparison.
Yeah, you know, whichever.
I like it.
Thank you.
I like it.
It's, I mean, I try to be understanding, because at the end of the day, look, I don't know what's going to happen to me after, you know, after I finally die from orgasm, which I'm really hoping is the way I go out.
Come on. That's got to be in the top five ways
Like, come on. Like, throw me a bone here too, Jesus or Buddha or whatever the fuck. But there's a theory of reincarnation where it's like, okay, you're actually going to be living every human being's life that's ever existed before you reach nirvana, right? And so I try and really be intuitive and understand that, like, when people are scared, they're scared. Whatever the foundation of those fears are, is, you know, I don't have anything to do with it. For instance, my fiance is scared as fuck of raccoons. I think they're cute as fuck. Like, I try not to laugh at him when he sees a raccoon and he's like,
I'm out. How often does he see a raccoon?
I mean,
it's like Fleabag. They're following him around like the foxes.
Well, so I don't know if you know this, but he's, you know, for him being from Ireland, right? There's no raccoons in Ireland. And so the very first time he saw a raccoon, he saw multiple raccoons because they were slinking out of bushes where he was standing and like waiting for like a ride. And you know how they kind of creep on all fours?
Oh, they're weird. Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of creep on all fours. He was like, nah, fuck that. I think he just left. I can't remember what he did, but he did not wait for that Uber. He was like, nah. He probably went to go get a drink, not because he's Irish, but because he's my fiance.
Well, you know, as long as his cultural addictions flow nicely into y'all's family life, then it's all good.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. It's considering one of those things where, you know, we just got to designate who's hungover what day, right? And who's dealing with the kids. You know what I mean? Because we can get drunk and out together, but when we do have kids, it's like, okay, I'll be hungover Saturday morning. So you take care of the kids Saturday morning, and then you can be hungover Sunday morning, and I'll take care of the kids Sunday morning. You know, we'll just trade off. It'll be fine.
Fear of raccoons. Yeah, I grew up in Kentucky. You can't have a fear of raccoons, like, or possums or squirrels. So
and possums. I'm a huge fan of like pretty much all animals except for primates. I know humans are included in that. Humans are okay. But primates in general kind of fuck me up. I don't know.
Animals are weird. Like, you ever just go, oh, wait a minute. This animal does what?
Yeah. There's three in my house, including my fiance, the dog and the cat over here. The dog is over here fucking sleeping. And he's mad at me because I put a cone on his head because he ripped his little toe pad off or whatever and I had to treat it. But he's all pissed off at me like, oh, how dare you want to take care of me, mom? Fuck you. And the cat, she's just kind of like, fuck you in general. So it's like, why am I doing this? Why do I keep them around? Like, they're weird as fuck.
They are weird. It's weird that we just have, oh, yeah, I'm going to let this animal live in my house. You wouldn't put a kangaroo in there.
No.
Right? There's no other animal. Like, what else would you put in your house? Like,
oh,
like snakes make no sense to me at all. It's like, if it gets out of its cage and I want to kill it, that's not a pet. That's a threat.
Okay. But wait, isn't that a spouse? Like, if you want to kill it, they're a threat at any point in time.
Hey, it's, you know, I'm at the age where like almost everybody I know has gone through their marriage or their two marriages. And now they're looking out going, you know what? I don't think I want that. I don't want that genre in my life.
No, I don't want this pet. I don't want this animal. They're an animal. We're all animals. I don't want this other animal in my house who's just as smart as me, who eats the same kind of food. And when I tell them to sit, I mean, they do it because we're role playing. But the point is that like they'll get you back. No, yeah, I mean,
they're tricky.
Animals are crazy. But if I could have one domesticated animal that could like do whatever I wanted and, you know, they're wild right now, it'd be a Wolverine, dude. Wolverines are big as fuck and they're fierce as fuck. Could you imagine? I'm like walking down the street with the Wolverine. The Wolverine's got a chain on. I've got a chain on, you know, and we're just like strolling through the hood. Like, I'm not a hood at all, but I try to be.
I like it. Wolverines. Yeah.
Right? What about you? Any wild animal.
What I always wanted was for somebody to genetically shrink down like elephants and hippos and rhinos, like to like hamster size. Like, how cool would that be?
Or
even like chihuahua size. Having like a chihuahua size elephant.
Yes.
Walking around.
Oh, 100%. Okay. What about, chihuahua size elephant. Yes. Rhinos, that might be too dangerous.
They got to go small, you know, and they got around home. They got around, they got to evolve to a round horn.
Yeah. 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 Or giraffes. Oh my God. So cute. So cute. Like,
the whole African savannah, if you just shrink it down,
completely
cute as shit.
Well, except for lions, because if they were just chihuahua size, it would just be an angry.
That'd be too
cat.
Much. Well, your cats, I mean, you've noticed like how small we've shrunk cats because they're just at the level where, like, when they come up to you and they feel you, Yeah. Like this.
Yeah.
That's, they're testing your muscle strength. It's like, nah, that bitch could still take me. I'm not. Soon though. Soon. She gets older.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, she plays all cute with me and she likes to snuggle and everything. But if I was bite size, if I was like only like 4 or 5 inches tall, she'd kill the shit out of me. And she wouldn't even think twice about it.
If they broke 30 pounds consistently, it's like the bats down here in Austin always bugs me. It's like, oh, let's go see the bats. Well, it's because the bats are about this big.
Yes.
If they were this big, nobody'd be down there looking at the bats. They'd be down there with shotguns. We got to get rid of these bats. These things
are so weird. Like,
terrifying.
I lived in Austin for 7 years and I never was like, I want to go see these flying mammals that may or may not shit on me. If I want to get shit on, I can pay somebody for that.
Well, they all fly out that way, so you're not going to get shit on. My thing was, like, I always wanted to see them turn around once. Like, once a year, the bats turn, and they just come back at the humans on the bridge, and just like, just attack. And you never know what night it's going to be.
Well, you know, it's Austin, so, you know, with our hippie asses in Austin, no one would fight back. They would just be like, I'm dying for the good of humanity.
And the bats, like, it takes, I don't know, like, when you go down there, it'll take, like, 2 hours for all of them to go. There's 3 million bats. I'm like, what are the last bats doing? Just sitting back there going, again?
Yeah.
The bats snooze, coming out in a little bat wheelchair. It's like, shit. This is not an accessible bridge.
It's like traffic on the one Mopac. They're just all the way in the back. They just happen to live all the way north and trying to get downtown. Like, man, fuck. Like, these bugs don't even taste that good. What the fuck am I doing?
You miss Austin?
Oh, yeah. I do. I really do miss Austin. I love the Bay Area. I love everything that it offers. The climate is pretty tight. I mean, except for the wildfires. But, you know, I mean, if I'm going to die of cancer, that'll probably be it.
From the fires?
Oh, yeah, dude. The wildfires? Shit.
They give you cancer?
Dude, they burned so much that, like, houses and smog and stuff that goes into the air. Last year when we were experiencing those wildfires, they were, like, 3 days straight where we woke up and the entire sky was orange. That's how bad it was. And so there's so much pollutants in the air. Just, you know, yeah, I mean, they're burning through the forest, but they're, like, tearing through all these neighborhoods and stuff. That it's like a concern for the people who live out here long-term. All of the chemicals that we're just kind of ingesting, let alone the fact that, I mean, you know, the smog normally being here. So, you know, I love it out here. I love the multiculturalism that I don't think you necessarily get in Austin. The public transit out here is pretty fire, as long as you don't mind, you know, dudes taking a shit on the train. You get used to it. And
that statement right there. It's just God taking a shit on the train.
Yeah, I mean, you just move to the next train. It's like, you know, like the next little cart. That's BART, man. That's BART. Any listeners out there that know what BART is, they'll know. Like, it's I remember they sent a survey out right when, I think towards the beginning of this year, as people started really signing up for more vaccines and stuff, which I'm fully vaccinated. Yay. And BART sent out a survey and they were like, so how did you like BART before the pandemic? Did you ride BART during the pandemic? And what would make you ride BART again? I was like, man, as far as I'm concerned, BART caused the pandemic. Like, all the fucking germs and disease on that shit. Like, I'm gonna catch COVID-20 in that bitch. I was like, if y'all
like COVID's like down the New York City subways going, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know realistically that it's kind of out of the hands of people who run BART, because, you know, it's as bad of a problem as homelessness. It's like systemic, right? It's like they can only do so much with the amount of funds that they're allotted. But I'm just glad that we have the kind of public transit out here that doesn't exist in Texas, which causes kind of a, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy of drinking and driving in Texas. Like, you know, I mean,
well, you gotta drink, you're in Texas.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You gotta drive.
Yeah. I've told this to many friends out here that it is kind of unspoken, the drinking and driving culture in Texas. Like it is what it is, because there's no real alternative, you know. And I'm not saying I condone it, but I'm not going to sit here and be like, yeah, I'm perfect either. It's just the fact of the matter is that there's just no reliable public transit that is consistent in Texas. And I know that is pretty much due to, you know, the oil companies. That's what Texas is. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous not having that reliability. You remember when, I don't know if y'all voted on this again, but like 4 or 5 years ago or something, we were voting on extending the rail from North Austin to down to South Austin and, you know, extending even the hours. And I voted and I was like, yeah, it's gonna happen. And they shot that shit down. I was like, man, what the hell? It's like, what is that? Like
maybe they did some of that. I remember them doing some construction a couple of years ago.
Hmm.
But just, again, it's just sort of throwing a little bit of yeah at them. They don't really ever, you know, change it.
No.
I don't know. I miss California. I would move back to LA, but I'm not going to be working in TV again. So I don't really want to work for a corporation. So I don't know if I can make the money to, you know, be comfortable in California again.
Yeah. Look, honestly, I'll tell this to anybody, man, stay out unless you know for sure that whatever you secure out here is going to be tight. Cause I mean, it's just crazy. And I mean, you would think it'd be, I don't know, maybe the cost of living had gotten less because of the pandemic. Nah, nothing. That has not changed at all. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, no wonder that homelessness is a problem in California. Like, it's just,
yeah,
you know, like, why is it that everything is so expensive? Like, it's just kind of baffling in the fact that we have some of the richest people living out here and we aren't able to tax them or their businesses sufficiently to address some of our wellness issues. Homelessness is a wellness problem. It's not a, you know, it's not a lack of work ethic or shit like that. I mean, man, bad things could befall me and my fiance or my pets at any point in time.
Your pets
and
it could go homeless.
Bad luck, and I'd be homeless. And I mean, you know, yeah, Dan, you'd probably be like, Divine, you deserved it. And I did, but most people don't. Like that's
nobody,
you know,
deserves,
I mean,
it. Like, you shouldn't live in a country, like a culture that when people drop, you know, and everybody drops for different reasons, it can't happen to almost anybody unless you've got wealth to keep you from dropping. You have to deal with that in a culture. Every culture has it. So you have to have ways of dealing with it. And capitalism is always just like, yeah, I'm not going to deal with that. Take it easy. You go figure that out. But it's just an immature way of doing a government and a country.
Oh, 100%. And you know, I won't get into too much of the red scare stuff, but the perceptions of communism and socialism have been wrecked in this country. And that's, you know, our own country's propaganda. But understandably, there are countries now who are running under those ideals, and things have failed as well. And there is no, it doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't have to be capitalism.
Yeah, social,
it doesn't have to be communism.
Socialism and democracy mix, and capitalism mix fine. Yeah. If you are careful and considered and do it right.
Exactly. And that's what I try to communicate to, you know, some people that are on the right. It's like, you know, you've got all sorts of socialist ideas or socialist programs now. Like, I don't have to pay anybody to stop my house from being on fire. Like I don't have to, you know, I don't have to hire anyone to beat up a black man. I just call the cops. Like, it's free. Like, this is just...
Bam. Take that. There you go. Socialist.
Yeah. Good, honest socialism. It's like, who can I, like, instead of hiring a hitman or hiring somebody to fuck up the niggas on the corner, just call the police. They're definitely going to shoot people for free. Like,
that's a great angle.
So it's, there's a lot of things that we can do, and it doesn't, there can be a middle person. Like, if you want to buy private health insurance, go ahead. Why the fuck does that have to be the only option, or working with a certain company to get private health insurance? Like, you know, to me, I like where I'm at with my company, you know, I'm cool with it and all of that, but it should not scare me to think about leaving and being like, I will not have health insurance. Like, cause I could be walking down the street and get attacked by, I don't know, a fucking
Wolverine.
Yeah. Or a mountain lion. Yo, there's like mountain lions in our neighborhoods. And I don't know if that's just a California thing or or a neighborhood thing, but there's like a lot of mountain lions.
They're liberal mountain lions.
Yeah, they're
hunting liberals. That's what they eat.
We fuel them. We fuel them with all of our rainbows and acceptance.
All right, man. Well, this has been super fun. I really appreciate you jumping on in your Friday evening and hanging out a little bit.
Absolutely, man. I enjoyed this. It's always so much fun to talk to you and just, you know, be a part of your life because you're kick ass and you're awesome. And yeah, this definitely made my week.
Well, cool. You killed it. So much fun. You got ideas in there. You got information. You got jokes. Come on. How could you not like that? That's Devanya Batiste, everybody, right there. Hey, thanks for hanging out. Thanks everybody for coming to the Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and persuade some people. They always need it.